The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Robert Marston. I'm the director of the City Bible Forum here in Melbourne, and we're co-hosting this event with Cross Culture this weekend. Now, I'd like to invite Andrew and Chris to come up to the front now. So there's been a number of questions come through, and we're in for a fascinating and I think interesting conversation now as we continue probing these questions and so on. Sorry, Sam, do you want to just take this and stand down? That'd be great. We'll endeavour to answer. There's been a number of questions. We'll endeavour to get through them in the time we've got now. We've got about another half an hour or so before one or two. Oh, there's another question. Thank you. We'll start off just with maybe just a couple of clarifying questions to both of you. Chris, you mentioned Thomas Nagel's book. Are you able to just explain? Well, the title sounds very impressive, but what's the substance of the book?
Not having read the book, but having read a bit about it and having started the book but not finished it, I think the substance of the book is very, very roughly what you would also find in the later editions of C.S. Lewis's book called Miracles, or for those who are familiar with philosophy, Alvin Plantinga's evolutionary argument against naturalism. And the theory is that if you take seriously a scientific worldview, that is to say, that science answers all the questions, then on the basis of that worldview, on the basis of our understanding, based on science alone, of how human beings have developed through evolution and come to the point that we're at now, does that worldview give you confidence that it can answer the fundamental grounding for human rationality and consciousness? Because if that worldview actually undermines the possibility of human beings being rational animals, because on that worldview we are rational animals, but if it doesn't offer you reasons for believing that human beings are rational and coming in touch with the truth, then that worldview shoots itself in the foot, because that worldview claims to be true. But if based on that worldview you can't be confident that human beings are rational and are finding the truth, then you ought not to believe that worldview. That's roughly it. Putting it in simpler terms, it simply doesn't answer, that worldview simply doesn't answer or offer reasons for us having believing in the things that we really do believe in, like we're getting in touch with the truth of the world and we are conscious, we have free will, things like that. And if that worldview undermines those things, then it undermines itself.
Yeah. Okay, well, that's obviously put it on the reading list and you can have a bit of a read of that yourself and maybe read those other books yourself as well and consider that. A question for you, Andrew, clarifying question. You've presented the history of interpretation of Genesis 1, but someone's asked, and I think it's a very helpful question to get us thinking about, how did or do Jews, who after all wrote the text, regard?
Yes, no. While my interpretation was focused on Christian, my study was focused on Christian interpretation, I've begun to sort of broaden that out a little bit. Today, I'm not really sure, except to say that when you read a Jewish Old Testament scholar, they often write no differently from a Christian Old Testament scholar as far as the meaning of the text and that the broad historical critical assumptions are fairly widely shared there. There's an interesting interaction. The literal interpretation that was really dominant in the Christian world in the Reformation, and not just Protestants but Catholics as well, became very popular, probably was Jewish influenced, because in the middle to late Middle Ages, Christian interpreters were spending time with Jews, Jewish thinkers, and learning a lot from them and becoming better acquainted with the Hebrew text. And so there was a lot of cross-fertilization in those eras. And it was a time when Jewish interpretation was very keen to be philosophically robust. And so there are these great Jewish philosophers in around the 11th to 13th centuries, 11th to 14th centuries, articulating philosophically powerful renditions of the Genesis creation account, and they influenced Christian interpretation. Earlier on, they were a little more divergent, I would say.
Maybe there's been a couple of questions already, again, asking, maybe just to clarify, for you to flesh out, in your presentation, you outlined a number of different ways. I think it's interesting for us all to realise how many different ways that the text has been understood in the past. Someone asked specifically what the dominant interpretation was in 400 AD. I suppose around that time of Augustine, I'm not quite sure if you, perhaps you could clarify a bit more on that as well.
Yes. Well, let me comment on Augustine himself, because his interpretation was so significant that it was the position you either had to adopt or critique for the next 1,000 years in the Christian world. And he was influenced in the early days by the allegorism that came out of the Alexandrian school by Origen and Clement.
So can you see, what's that Alexandrian school? Sorry,
yeah, so the Alexandrian school is known for its commitment to allegory and its use of allegory.
Right.
So Origen
based
says...
the city of Alexandria.
Yeah,
that's right. Some guy called...
Yeah, that's right. Right. Yeah, the city, that's right. So it was a very important city in those days. And Origen was the guy who said, you know, what person with a brain in their head, so I'll paraphrase, would possibly believe that light appeared 3 days before the sun? That was his indication of saying, look, the text tells us not to take itself literally. So Augustine was influenced by that allegorical friend from Alexandria, but he was really unhappy to abandon a literal interpretation. And he set himself the goal of writing a Genesis commentary that he could call a literal commentary, but that dealt with all the philosophical realities that they understood there to be. That was a major challenge. He tried twice. His first one was more allegorical and moral, and then he set himself the goal of writing a literal one. His next one was unfinished, and then one of the great works of his life before he died was his Genesis according to the literal meaning. His literal interpretation of Genesis was that the 7 days of creation saw no lapse of time, but there were stages in increased awareness in the angelic mind of the ideals of creation in the mind of God and then their material realization. So in the evening, that was when they, the mornings were when they saw the ideals as the true ideal backbone of creation, and then the evenings were the lesser times when they saw these things realized. None of it was involved with time. In other words, the account's not really about the passage of time. As I said, the Platonic worldview is an essential component of that. Take away the Platonism and it doesn't make a great deal of sense. But Platonism dominated the next 800 years to some extent in church history. And so that was a view that people always had to speak to because of Augustine's stature. So that's about 400. One of the popes, Gregory the Great, in a work that wasn't about Genesis, he really articulated a mediating position that made most people happy for a long time, and that was the instantaneous thing is the matter of creation that was made at the start, Genesis 1:1, and then its arrangement into a livable world that took the 6 days. And so that was a kind of a common sense mediating position, a bit more literal than Augustine's, and that satisfied a lot of people.
Okay, so the question goes on to ask, when did the sort of gap theories and evolutionary explanations, etc., come about?
Mm-hmm. The gap theory, that idea that there is time before the creation week to account for an angelic drama, you know, that the war on the angels and the angels being cast out of heaven, that's really coming into form with the Arminian thinkers in the 1600s in Holland, Episcopius and Grotius and those guys. It acquires a geological tone in the late 1700s. So there's a German called J.G. Rosenmüller, and he wrote a work describing geological eras taking place in that gap. In day-age terms, I've been interested to try and track down when I can see this emerging, and it's roughly the same time.
So it's the same time as the Arminians, or same time as the...
As Rosenmüller.
Right, okay.
So that means that...
So that's 1700s.
Yeah, around about 1750... 1760, 1770. There was a French popularizer of science called Louis de Buffon, and he wrote one of these great big works that in those days people would pay money for. And in that work, a late volume uses a day-age explanation for the origin of the world. So that's 1778, off the top of my head. So it's very clear by then.
Terrific. Okay, thanks. Maybe so that just upon the ages and the nature of interpretation, someone's also asked what the oldest interpretations are. I suppose you've touched on that in some ways, but is there a way of identifying the oldest interpretations, and is that significant, and how to expand on that?
Yes, this is interesting. If you want the oldest biblical interpretation, is probably reflected in the references to the creation week in the Ten Commandments in Exodus 20, and then again Exodus 31, and they sound rather simple and literal. By the intertestamental literature, in the Book of Jubilees, there's a desire to kind of map out all of history in terms of the religious year, really, the religious calendar. And so it's already turning into a way of understanding phases of history. So the first Christian writing that I can identify, the letter to Barnabas that talks about this, uses that world week model, where the reason the Genesis 1 is referred to is as a way of understanding the breakdown of history and what can be expected next. So it's turning into eschatology in some way.
Mm-hmm.
Does that, do you
explain what eschatology is?
Yes.
So we're not all studying theology.
No, that's right. So we read the creation week, we naturally think it's talking about the beginning of the world, but already in the letter to Barnabas, it's already being understood to say something about the end of the world, when it's understood as a plan for history, a seven-stage breakdown of what can be expected to happen. And so that is really quite a non-literal treatment of the chapter. But you see literal and figurative existing side by side for a long time, and not uncommonly in the same interpreter. So in the Middle Ages, you would offer three or four different interpretations of Genesis. There'd be a literal one, one for moral growth and benefit, one concerning Christ, one concerning philosophical reality. In the Renaissance, they figured 7-day week, we have to try and offer seven explanations, and they did that a couple of times.
Right, so that seemed to be one of the things that emerged from your presentation, was that these days we tend to reduce it to one interpretation, but it seems as though people were very happy to have multiple interpretations in ancient times.
So that's very much anchored in worldview. So if you think the world is essentially of one kind, reality is essentially physical, which I'd say describes many around us very well, maybe ourselves, then you are going to tend to look for the physical explanatory power of a chapter like Genesis 1. But if you believe the world is multi-layered, and there is the heavens of God, and then there are the heavens of the angels, and then there's the heaven that contains the planets, and then there's our earth, and then there are other layers of reality, not just a physical stack, but a stack of existence, then you're going to look for meaning on each of those decks, essentially. So that's unusual to our way, I think.
Okay, thanks. Let's have some conflict, because Chris has mentioned, he's mentioned that his presentation was entitled "The Conflict." There's been a couple of questions that have come through, perhaps talking about continuing. If the world was, you're suggesting that there's, you suggested that there is no conflict because science deals with the how, Christianity deals with the why. But when it comes to origins, the Bible suggests that the world was created over 6 days, and it didn't happen over billions of years. Man was created from the dust, woman from man's side. Or did they evolve from ape-like creatures? Did death and suffering exist, come before man's sin, or did it exist before man
Does not this constitute a real conflict? Let's begin with the conflict.
Yes. It does constitute a conflict if you are absolutely convinced that science and biblical interpretation are answering the same question. So I gave the example of certain questions that we can ask, and I suggested there are different ways of understanding those questions, like, why is the water boiling? I said that why is the water boiling is actually two questions covered up by one phraseology. One about purposes, one about particles, one about meanings, one about mechanisms. But if you are convinced that the beginning of Genesis is answering questions about how and how many blocks of units of time and things like that, if you are convinced about that, then you're saying that the beginning of Genesis is answering the same questions as science is answering. And then you obviously have a conflict. Yes. What I'm suggesting is, and Andrew might care to continue, what I'm suggesting is, well, to put it bluntly, I think that we are misinterpreting Genesis. Andrew said that Genesis wasn't poetry, but nor is it prose. To a simple...
Clarify, what you said it was elevated prose. Do you want to clarify, perhaps, ask Christian, what do you mean by elevated prose there?
It's highly structured, so it's not simple storytelling, but it has this clear structure of the days with lots of formulae in it, so highly structured.
I thought you said it wasn't. You said it wasn't poetry.
Yes.
There's many people call it poetry. Well, it's not actually typical of Hebrew poetry.
Yes.
So it's elevated prose.
Yeah.
The point that I was making was, it depends on your presuppositions about how you approach Genesis. And I think that if we go with those let me go back a little bit. I think that actually we've been duped. I think that we've been duped by science. It's only the last few hundred years that we've been given this model of science that has all the answers. And I think that what Christians have tended to do, notwithstanding the long history that Andrew's talked about, but particularly nowadays, what Christians have tended to do is say, but first of all, step one, buy the wrong view of science, by B-U-Y. We've bought the wrong view of science, the view of science that says science is about certain proven truth. And that's wrong, but we won't go into it anymore now. But once you buy that view of science, that science is about certain proven truth, if you then turn to your faith and you say, well, I want my faith to be robust. How can I make my faith robust? Well, we have this model of certain proven truth, and it's the scientific model. So I grab that model and I lay it on my faith and say, my faith must look like this. Now, there's a double danger there. One is saying that faith must look like science. But even worse, if you buy a wrong view of science, then you're taking a view of science that that is wrong in the first place and trying to squeeze your faith into that model of science. So... I mean, part of the reason I'm doing a doctorate in the field is because I think we have to go a step further back than the arguments about interpretation of Genesis. I think we as Christians need to be part of the conversation about understanding the nature of science itself. Because our society and the Richard Dawkins and the Lawrence Krausses have brought a completely wrong view of science. Although they're scientists, they do their science. They're not philosophers of science. They have not examined carefully the nature of science. They don't even realise all the presuppositions that they're introducing into their science. So if we buy a wrong view of science, we've gone wrong immediately if we start to make Genesis look like science.
I'll ask a follow-up question, but Andrew, do you want to care to comment? Considering it's kind of more helpful that you, these two presentations are together, we can discuss this together. What are your comments on understanding Genesis?
My take briefly on the relationship of science and faith there is that they are serving different purposes and doing different things. So it's a bit of an apple and orange comparison. However, I think each has a philosophical corollary, or it has consequences philosophically that do tend to overlap. And I think that's why we perceive that there's an uneasy relationship between the dominant paradigm of origins, you know, evolutionary science, and Genesis 1. And one thing that I think it comes down to with regard to the text of Genesis is, if this originated from the ancient world, albeit revelation, if that's what you believe, then is there anything in that chapter that suffers from any degree of obsolescence on account of having arisen from the ancient world? And so I think that's where the question can get a little bit pointy. And one way that you can actually think about that is to simply say, well, I'll do my best to understand what that firmament thing is in Genesis 1, the rakia in Hebrew, and once I've understood it as well as I can, try to be as honest to the text as I can as to whether it's two-dimensional or three-dimensional, etc., do I believe it's there? And so I've noticed some modern creation accounts that will put a surface way, way out there, out beyond the stars. We'll put a solid surface there. This is in James Jordan's book, a Florida dude I know nothing else about. He wrote a book on creation, and his cosmology was all the way out there beyond the stars. There is this solid surface, and effectively it's the ceiling of our world and it's the floor of heaven. That was essentially his cosmology. In essence, he was saying we've got to stick with every detail of Genesis 1. There was a moment in a conversation between Thomas Burnett and Isaac Newton, and Newton was defending Genesis 1, and Thomas Burnett, who was more of a bit of a skeptic, he was saying, Newton, if there's any way you can tell me this, how in the world can there be a firmament with waters above the heavens, waters above it, but stars and planets in it, which is the way that the language of Genesis 1 speaks? And he was just saying, you know, by any way, you know, try and explain that to me. And I actually think that is where we face the fact that a cosmogony from the ancient world will bear some of the marks of an ancient worldview. And I'm not sure we can get away from that.
Okay, well, my follow-up question to you, Chris, then, is, I suppose, the nature of this conflict, and this is, I think, where a lot of the conflict and tension comes, is particularly when you move from Genesis 1 and move into Genesis 2, etc., moving into figures of an historical Adam, and events, and then there seems to be a trajectory that moves as though it begins to outline world history, and that the argument would go, well, the argument to suggest that if you're, to what extent are you denying a kind of historical Adam, historical fall, then to what extent would you deny the gospel, and the kind of the historical trajectory that Genesis seems to be presenting there. I suppose that seems to be, because if you, I suppose, to what extent are you removing a historical scientific kind of understanding of that? So is that the kind of the follow-up question that would come, I think, from the question that's sort of, it's coming here, I'm just trying to expand that. Do you want to comment?
No.
We've got 5 minutes.
I guess that one of my and, you know, I'm speaking very personally now, one of my interpretive keys of looking at the scriptures, as a person who believes that the scriptures are inspired by God, but as a person who also believes that the centre of interpretation is the life and death and resurrection of Jesus Christ our Lord, and as a person who also believes that on the whole and for the most part science is getting in touch with truth, which is not to say every little bitty thing that scientists happen to believe today, but on the whole science is a valid human endeavour. When I put all those sorts of things together, I don't find myself having to commit myself on everything that other people would like me to commit myself on. So if you ask me about historical Adam and Eve, and you ask me, and science tells us that the human race can trace its origins back to a common Eve, and Eve in inverted commas, and a common Adam who may or may not have lived at the same time in North Africa, do I have to say what I think is the way of coordinating those bits of information? I don't think as a Christian I do. I don't think as a Christian I have to say to what degree and where geographically and what year Adam and Eve lived or didn't live or whatever. I do have to say, I think, as a Christian, that human beings are distinct because God made human beings distinct, and that distinctness is summed up in we are made in the image of God. That is fundamental theologically to Christian faith. How God did it and when God did it, and how, you know, who Adam was and who Adam's children were and who they married and all those sorts of questions, I don't feel like I have to answer all those sorts of questions. And so if I'm arguing with somebody, whether they be Christian or non-Christian, what I want to do is keep on going back to the things that theologically we have to affirm. And we have to affirm that human beings are made in the image of God. God did it. It didn't happen by accident. What the not by accident looks like is very difficult to know. And I think science is getting in touch with some of that.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's another question that's just come through then, but on that, which touches on this question. Science and religion are asking two different questions. Do they, and to what extent do they overlap? We're saying that scientists can say one thing and theologians say another, and it's okay. I think perhaps going beyond the question is it to what extent could you say that they could say different things and it's okay, I suppose? That's perhaps
different things about the same question.
Yeah.
Well, my point is that for the most part, and obviously these are simplifications, but for the most part they're answering different questions. And if they're answering different questions, then they're not going to have a conflict.
That's correct.
The conflict comes if they're answering the same question.
So the question is, to what extent do they overlap?
Well, I think they do overlap. I mean, obviously, there are potential areas of conflict. If science could prove that the resurrection body or that the body of Jesus Christ didn't exist or that Jesus didn't exist or something like that, Christianity is also a historical faith. We claim that Jesus existed as a living human being, died and rose again in more than just the minds of the disciples. That is central to Christian faith. If science, and those are in one sense scientific questions because they're questions about real flesh and blood physical existence on the planet Earth at a particular time and place. Conceivable conflict, yes, but it's difficult to imagine how science could go about showing that Jesus didn't exist.
I suppose there are some.
So that's an overlap. That yes. Is an overlap.
Well, I suppose there are some that. Well, I know Richard Dawkins claims that Adam and Eve, for example, never existed. I mean, if the Bible considers them historical figures as well, perhaps would there be another overlap there in origins? And if the evolutionary paradigm, as suggested by someone like Dawkins, would say was true, then would there be another opportunity for overlap there? I'm not sure if you.
Well, let's take the Dawkins line to the extreme. Say, after another 100 years of science, scientists are absolutely convinced and can show conceivable mechanisms, which they can't at the moment, can show conceivable mechanisms right from the first cell, right through an evolutionary development that results in human beings. So what? Does that still say that God didn't decide to make human beings in his own image? No. It shows us something. If we accept the story, and in 100 years, if we accept the story, it shows us something simply of a process. But it shows us nothing scientifically of God's involvement in that process. God's involvement in that process is a theological claim, something that science will never, no matter how far science goes, be able to show. But if you think that our faith needs to be scientific and therefore is going into bat against science, then you do have a problem on your hands. We can make those theological claims that human beings are made in the image of God irrespective of where science is at in 100 or 1,000 years time.
Another quick question, just flowing on from that directly, and then we'll get you talking again, Andrew, although you can make some comments as well. This is a sort of talking about experiment. The Bible talks about demons and spirits. Should there be science or experiments done on these? There are other things which the Bible say which still conflict with experimental science. For example, the Bible talks about demons and spirits. Should there be science or experiments done on these?
Excuse me. Demons or spirits are a little bit like human beings in the sense that we understand them to have free will. How you do experiments on beings that have free will, that can choose to presumably reveal themselves or not reveal themselves at will, when science is about what is regular and what can be set up in an experiment and tested in an experiment, because what is regular will always happen, you're dealing with two different realms. And within brackets, you're also dealing with the realm of whether psychology, for example, is science. To what degree is psychology science? It's like the experiments on prayer. Well, does prayer work? Let's do a scientific experiment. But prayer isn't of the nature that every time you pray in the right way, it will work, and if you don't pray in the right way, it won't work. Therefore, it's rule-governed. Prayer isn't rule-governed. Prayer is governed by the will of God and the will of human beings, and mostly the will of God. And the will of God won't be subject to scientific testing.
Okay, thanks. Andrew, any comments from what Chris has been saying, particularly from your research just through interpretation of Genesis 1 and so on?
It's just funny that Augustine was quite gobsmacked that the creation of angels wasn't mentioned in Genesis 1 when it was such an important part of the structure of the world, their existence. And so he actually, by the time he finished interpreting it, angels were really the centre of the action in Genesis 1, even though never hinted at. So, which is just a good illustration of the way our interpretive framework can shape the task of interpretation that we do. That's just an interesting sideline.
No, that's right. So how did you do that?
Well, because he basically began with the premise, well, angels could not possibly be omitted from Genesis 1. So even though it really looks like they are, they can't be. Others worried about it as well. But that's why he effectively had the creation week as the perception of the angels. So when you create heavens and earth at the start, the heavens must include the angels that populate them. And then from that time on, all the action is seen through their eyes. It's angelic perception that's telling you what's happening in the days of creation. Well, you can see it there if you can see it there.
Well, maybe just another follow-up question. You outlined a number of different ways in which Genesis is sort of understood even today. Is one more legitimate than another?
Yeah, well, I'm no relativist, so I do still believe in what they call historical grammatical interpretation, just actually asking the question what the text says, mm-hmm. and understanding I retain a place for author intention, meaning you want to know what the writer actually meant to say. Unlike some Christian interpreters, I actually would reserve a place. If we believe a text is revelatory or inspired, then it could probably mean more in divine intention than what the human author intended. And so I actually retain a place for, I think, what Catholic tradition has called a sensus plenae, or a fuller sense, although I wouldn't interpret that in really mystical or allegorical ways. But I think a text can outgrow the mind of the biblical writer. Let me illustrate with something that came out of a recent seminar at Ridley College with John Walton over there. His big point was that Genesis 1 was about function and not about form, because that's the way creation was understood in the ancient world. People wanted to know, what does this do? What's its right place? Rather than physically, how's it put together? But I don't really fully agree with him, because I can't see that form is not concerned at all in Genesis 1. It seems to want to say something about the forms of the world. I think the question is it said in a schematic sort of way? So that's a word I like to bring to Genesis 1, is the idea of a schema or a schematic. A schematic diagram of the electrical circuitry in a building does not have to have the right dimensions of the building, It does not have to accord with the physical shape of the building as we know. It has to communicate information in a certain way that is true, but might not be a photographic resemblance of the physical truth. So I would understand Genesis 1 in a schematic way. I think it's talking about the real world, it's talking about the physical world, and communicating theological truths as well. But I don't understand it in history in the same sense as accounts of Abraham or stories about David.
I think we're just about run out of time. Both Chris and Andrew will be around at morning tea. Just if you want to have some more questions or you'd like to clarify some things, then I'm sure that they'd be happy to take some questions or perhaps run away. I'm not quite sure what they'd prefer to do. Please thank our presenters, Andrew Graham and Brown.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.